Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, having known Samuel Beckett for over 14 years and having worked with him 7 times in the theater and for television, talking about the art of Samuel Beckett very much means for me to talk about the man himself, about working with him, and by that, about some aspects of his work. Hopefully, the following fizzles will shed some light on his art. I vividly remember the moment I first saw him on the 27th of December 1974, shortly before 10 o'clock in the morning. He crossed the yard of the Schiller Theater in the then West Berlin, heading towards the stage door. His head bowed, his walk slightly swaying, a brown slim portfolio held against his right hip, an image of calmness and peaceful isolation. I rushed down the stairs from the fourth floor just in time to hear the doorman say, "Hello, Mr. Beckett, good to see you again." He was an old acquaintance, since he had directed 4 times at this theater before he came to direct his first Waiting for Godot. I took him straight to the stage where preparations for the so-called Bauprobe, as we say in German, were being made. Yes, all requirements of the set in its original dimensions were indicated and marked. A bare stage with black legs left and right and a gauze scrim as a horizon across the back. A stone downstage audience left and a tree upstage right. Samuel Beckett talked to his French set designer, Matthias. I tried to take part in the conversation. I overcame my shyness and tried to ask something very relevant and very, very intelligent. Is it supposed to be a real stone or a sculptured, Mr. Beckett? His answer was a frozen silence which I have never forgotten. That's done then, I thought. Beckett had prepared for the production for over 2 years. Since he felt he was not a director, he had to overcompensate, as he said. He knew the play by heart in German and directed like a conductor. He said it was a mess and he wanted to give order to the confusion. As it turned out in the course of rehearsals, he had a notebook which he consulted not often though. He had been asked whether he had an idea for a production poster, and he had chosen 2 pages of this notebook to serve the purpose. One day he gave it to me so it could be taken to the printers. I held this red hardcover book in my trembling hand. I ran to the next available Xerox machine, there weren't very many in those days, and copied the whole thing, 100 pages. I hadn't asked him. I felt bad at the time, but the temptation was too strong. Knowing now what he knew about the nature of the human race, I know he knew what I would do. The Godot notebook was not the first. Some have been published by now, and one gets access to them at the archives at Reading University. Whenever he mounted a production of his plays, Samuel Beckett in his notebooks summarized, categorized, analyzed, rationalized, intellectualized, and most important of all, he put down what he visualized. He made drawings and sketches of every action and movement to be performed on stage. Before rehearsals started, and he made corrections during rehearsals and at times after the play had premiered. Working with him was professional and coined by great mutual respect and friendliness. There was an atmosphere of unquestioned natural authority in the room whenever he was present. There were rare moments of irritation and painful frustration on his side too, but he never ever blamed anyone but himself if something went wrong or didn't work out. The charming result was that everyone did the best he could to comfort and help him and care for him. Samuel Beckett was the most amiable, gentle, lovable, vulnerable, and loyal man I ever met. But he could be irritable and harsh, and there was a volcano waiting to erupt underneath whenever the integrity of his work seemed to be endangered. He then could be relentlessly radical. In August 1987, I met him in the Café Français opposite his apartment on Boulevard Saint-Jacques in Paris, where he habitually met friends and visitors. The late Mike Nichols, director of the renowned films The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Gregory Mosher, who at the time ran the Lincoln Center in New York, and an American academic whom Beckett knew well, were there too. Nichols and Mosher had plans for a revival of Waiting for Godot at the Lincoln Center the following year. Samuel Beckett wanted me to supervise the production. They had the idea for a set located in the Nevada desert after a nuclear disaster to bring the play closer to an American audience, as they said. Beckett was more than skeptical and sat there in silence. There had been no production of Waiting for Godot in New York for several years because another producer held the rights and didn't get to terms with finding the right cast and to raise enough money. He very strongly had a Broadway production in mind. One of the actors he wanted in the cast was Dustin Hoffman, who went to meet Beckett in Paris, but he didn't turn up. Beckett was very upset. Hoffman later said he had been in Paris and had been scared to meet him. I believe him. The discussion about Broadway and why Broadway went on. Beckett argued that it was a very simple play and could be performed anywhere. The discussion went on for a while, Beckett sitting there in silence. All of a sudden, the 81-year-old man, amidst of this cafe, jumped up from his chair, thrust his forefinger of his right hand forward, and screamed at the highest pitch of his voice, "Fuck Broadway!" In 1960, Beckett's American director, Alan Schneider, was on rehearsals for the first American production of Krebslice Tape, and he had some correspondence with Beckett. When the curtain opens, we see the 69-year-old Krupp sitting at his table, facing front, a rearish old man, white face, purple nose, disordered gray hair, unshaven, very nearsighted, but unspectacled, hard of hearing. On the table, a tape recorder with microphone and a number of cardboard boxes containing reels of recorded tapes. The image shows a sketch by Jocelyn Herbert for the first English production at the Royal Court Theatre with Patrick McGee playing Crabbe, directed by Donald McWhinney. Whenever Samuel Beckett worked at the Royal Court Theatre, Jocelyn Herbert was his ingenious set and costume designer. She was, as Eileen just mentioned, his best friend in London. Crabbe has been a failure as a writer. It is his 69th birthday. It is his annual routine to listen to past recordings which he has made over the years before embarking on a new one, summing up the year which lies behind him. This evening he tries to remember a special moment of his past. He consults an old ledger and finds the entry "Farewell to Love" and a hint concerning the year and box and reel. It is a recording which he had made 30 years ago on his 39th birthday. It was the year when he had his vision of writing his opus magnum, his revelation. On the tape, we hear him beginning pompously, 39 today, sound like a bell, and intellectually at the crest of the wave, or thereabouts. And he continues, spiritually a year of profound gloom and indigence, until that memorable night in March at the end of the jetty in the howling wind, never to be forgotten, when suddenly I saw the whole thing, the vision at last. The 69-year-old mocks this 39-year-old, makes sarcastic remarks, jeers at him while listening to the moment of his revelation and enlightenment. He interrupts, winds the tape forward, can't bear the excitement of his younger other. Then all of a sudden, we witness one of the most beautiful farewell to love situations in literary history. Upper lake with a punt bathed off the bank, then pushed out into the stream and drifted. She lay stretched out on the floorboards with her hands under her head and her eyes closed. Sun blazing down, bit of a breeze, water nice and lively. I noticed a scratch on her thigh and asked her how she came by it. Picking gooseberries, she said. I said again I thought it was hopeless and no good going on. And she agreed, without opening her eyes. I asked her to look at me, and after a few moments, she did. But the eyes just slits because of the glare. I bent over her to get them in the shadow, and they opened. Let me in. We drifted among the flags and stuck. The way they went down, sighing before the stem. I lay down across her with my face in her breasts and my hand on her. We lay there without moving, but under us all moved and moved us gently up and down and from side to side. After the first German production of Crabbe's last tape, which premiered in September 1950 at the Schiller Theater in Berlin, in a double bill with the world premiere of Edward Albee's first play, The Zoo Story, Albee reported to Schneider that in Berlin they had added an extra speaker apart from the speaker in the tape recorder itself, and that it had worked well. That certainly referred to the audibility, since at the time the standards of internal speakers were not so high, one can assume. Beckett answered in a letter to Schneider of January 1960, "Know nothing whatever about extra speaker to tape recorder in Berlin, and am not sure what it means. If it does what I fear it does, it is plain murder and unpardonable. I dream sometimes of all German directors of plays, with perhaps one exception, united in one with his back to the wall and me shooting a bullet into his balls every 5 minutes till he loses his taste for improving authors." Why did Beckett respond to a seemingly marginal fact in such a drastic way? As much as his prose text, his text for the theater are composed of images. Furthermore, Samuel Beckett visualized precise stage images when writing his plays. For example, he visualized Krupp sitting at his table in his room in the way we saw him, we see him in the congenial sketch of Jocelyn Herbert's. He visualized physical actions and movements of his characters in a room or elsewhere. Everything was worked out and functional, and yet transcending the functional. As the following images show, Beckett had visualized specific attitudes for Krupp listening to the tape recorder. Seeing the images, one can understand how horrified Beckett must have been by the idea to have an extra speaker. That meant for him, and I'm sure he was right, that the connection between Krupp and his past as the essential feature of the play would be disrupted. Beckett wanted to establish the visible symbiotic relationship between the man and the machine. In the Krupp notebook, it says, under psychological, tape recorder companion of his solitude, masturbatory agent, tendency to become what is on the tape and the object of a corresponding negative-positive animation. Anger and tenderness of Krupp towards the object, which through language has become the stupid bastard, or to the girl on the lake. Krupp tape recorder relationship both fundamental and almost impossible to convey through the acting without descending to the level of the sentimental. He repeatedly dismissed the play as being sentimental, and to avoid sentimentality, he initially thought of Krupp as a sort of clown with purple nose and oversized narrow white boots. One must suspect this was a sort of camouflage, the play being so close to him. We see an early sketch from 1958 on the left side and a later one from 1973 on the right side. The sketch of 1973 shows us a far more realistic Krupp, and Jocelyn Herbert certainly had her share in it. In 1978, we worked together on a double bill. He directed play and I assisted him and directed Come and Go, and he would come to watch rehearsals. He rehearsed for 2 hours in the morning. Once when I went to see him in the late afternoon, he asked me what I had been doing during the day. "Rehearsing," I said. He couldn't believe it. "It's a 10-minute play," he said. "The play contains 121 words. Or 127, according to the published version. We did the full program." Here you see some sketches of Jocelyn Herbert's three women on a bench. They leave the bench in turns. Each time one of them is off, the other two start a mimed gossip unheard by the audience. They finish immediately after the one who had been out returns. In the end, all three sit there holding hands. Beckett called it a dramolette. One day he came to a rehearsal. Each of the women had plastic bags, shopping bags, on the ground at their feet. The auditorium was dark, the women on the bench brightly lit. We stood side by side in front of the first row. He watched the three women. Then his look went down to the plastic bags, to the women again, to the plastic bags, the women, the plastic bags. Then a deep sigh. Sam, all this will disappear, I whispered. He turned his head and whispered, Walter, I trust you. Later I explained to him that the actresses needed to have an answer to all those so-called W questions. Who am I? Where do I come from? What am I doing? What am I up to? So my designer and me invented this shopping bag situation for the rehearsal. I asked him whether there wasn't a concrete social context involved in a way. His answer was, it's all poetic, Walter. All poetic, which I kept in my mind to the very day. I didn't know then that in early drafts of the play, he had the women gossip about husbands, adultery, illnesses, and death, well to be heard by the audience. He had shaped and reshaped very concrete material until he arrived at this beautiful and enigmatic dramatic poem. Reduction, as it's well known, was his most important tool. When I directed Waiting for Godot at the Gate Theatre in Dublin in 1988, my set and costume designer was Louis Le Broki, one of the greatest Irish visual artists. I met him in Dublin, and not long after he sent me his suggestion for the set. In a letter he explained, no realism implied. The road is merely indicated. Each aspect of this simple linear imagery may be caused to emerge or recede from the mind as in memory. He thought of indicating a road into the distant Dublin mountains where Beckett used to go for long walks as a child holding his father's hand. The image was to be framed by very dark scribbled enclosure which merges into the white stage floor. I somehow liked it, but only somehow. I had no idea how to use it. I had no idea how I would match the indicated road with Beckett's precise choreography of the play, which I had in mind. Neither to make use of it, how was I to use an indicated road on the floor, made sense to me, nor not to use it, since it was there, indicated or not. It remained a visual artist's beautiful imagination. Beckett got me out of the dilemma. Louis Le Broki, his wife Anne Madden, and I met him in Paris. He had a long look at the sketch. He always looked very long and thoroughly at photos or paintings. He read them, at times scarily long, when he studied production photos of mine, for example. Finally, he looked up and said something like, well, what's this? Louis Le Broki started to explain. there is the road. There's no road. Loosely broken, it says in the text, a country road, a tree, evening. Ah, there's no road. Only the tree and the stone. Keep it simple. That's done that then, I thought. We dropped the image apart from the tree trunk with its two branches. We kept the scribbles on the flies and wings. Furthermore, there were scribbles on the costumes and the stone. When the production was revived in 1991, we decided to get rid of the scribbles as well. We agreed that it not only made the stage too busy, but that another artistic mind was at work, interfering with the play. Louis Le Broglie was a wonderful and understanding partner. This great artist invested an incredible amount of time and physical work to reshape the stage to utmost simplicity. The gauze scrim as horizon with all shades of gray, the stone and the tree were his and remained functional manifestations of his presence as an artist. He knew that. Here you see Beckett's design on a receipt of the cafe where we so often met. You see on the right side the back of this receipt. On the left side you see S for stone, the cross for the cross, by the way, a real, real cross, which reminds us of something. And the crossing situation, diagonal, and on the back, I noted what he said to me. I am a maniac minimalist. I exhibit myself only to you. And then he started to tell me the story of the Guinness Brewery. I was a very difficult young man, he said. And at times I didn't know what to do. And my parents had relations to the Guinness Brewery. And they thought it would be the best if I took a job as an accountant. I imagined Samuel Beckett in the Guinness Brewery. In 1976, Jocelyn Herbert worked with Beckett on the first production of Footfalls. The dress she created for Billy Whitelaw's May is legendary. Beckett was very proud of this dress somehow, and he showed it to a very young costume designer when he was about to direct the play in Berlin. And this poor girl, she shed tears because she didn't know how to go about it to achieve such a wonderful costume. She made a big career afterwards. This woman walking up and down on a strip of floorboard in total isolation says of her own semblance, gray rather than white, a pale shade of gray, tattered, a tangle of tatters. Beckett and Jocelyn Herbert took that literal. We see a painting which is in the National Gallery of Ireland and might have been an inspiration for Beckett concerning Billy Whitelaw positioning her arms, since he was an expert in the visual arts and he frequently was inspired by paintings. Billy Whitelaw in the dress as made by Jocelyn Herbert. And a sketch Jocelyn Herbert made secretly while Beckett himself was trying out May's stance, holding her physical self together. That is a particularly beautiful document of his deep attachment to his work. I found another sketch in the archive that strongly reminded me of my TV production of Footfalls with Billy in 1988. The question was how to transfer it to the medium TV in terms of using cuts, close-ups, and so on. We decided not to do anything of the kind. Sitting in the control room one day, watching this long shot of 27 minutes was mind-blowing for us, and we kept it. It struck us as having a perfect balance of text and image containing all the loneliness and freezing isolation which we had been after. The loneliness and frozen isolation was all in it. Even on the screen, one can argue about it, whether a long shot over 25 minutes is a TV play, but I still love it. A word about updating. I'd like to talk about Lisa Dwan's trilogy, Not I, Footfalls, and Rockabye at the Royal Court Theatre in 2014. The set designer Alex Eales and I agreed from our first meeting on that all three pieces would emerge from the total darkness and float in space. Not I, 8 feet above the ground, as indicated in the text. Footfalls on an elevated strip of floorboard, as indicated in the text. The rocking chair perched up on an invisible rostrum, as indicated in the text. These poetic pieces were untouchable images for us, perfectly balanced compositions, musical scores. There was no alternative in sight, and yet the demon to be inventive at times nagged at me during long walks in Hyde Park in December after rehearsals, trying to avoid the Christmas market. I indulged in one tiny gimmick, which took me great pains to decide. There is a brick wall at the back of the stage at the Royal Court, and I fell in love with it. We opened the black back curtain so one had a glimpse of it in the subdued light of Rockabye, a tiny concession to reality in a ghostly world. Lisa had brought a vintage dress, meant to be a rehearsal dress. It became the dress for the production because it felt right. The dress of Rockabye was a different matter. Billy Whitelaw's black period dress covered with sequins was breathing down our neck since it looked precisely as described in the text. Could we in any way update it? For days, if not weeks, I was pursued by modish black dresses with sequins in window shops around Sloane Square. I walked around Harrod's special evening gown department just before Christmas. What was this man doing there? I went to Harvey Nicholson at Knightsbridge. We all went to this incredibly expensive Sloane Street boutique. Then the assistant dress designer came up with two period dresses very much looking like mother's best black as described in the text. It took a while to decide between the two. All we had seen before had been banal and without any secret. No getting away from Beckett's vision. Lisa Dwan plays not I, with a vigor as wild and frightening as Jocelyn Herbert's image of mouth, to the book an 8.5 instead of the original 5 minutes without losing one word. There is updating for you. She plays footfalls to the book, the music being all hers. She plays it relentlessly descending into the lower depths of her life and soul every night. She does the journey with the audience. There is updating for you. She performs rockabye with a subtle and stunningly concrete, tragic and poetic personal tone of voice that shocks audiences to the core. There is updating for you. Outwardly at times seemingly detached was Beckett emotionally deeply connected to his work. To hear him speak his lines was the best proof of it. The perfect expressionless expression which could move to tears. His aversion to any sort of phony overacting, his absolute ear can more than ever teach us a lesson about truth, since the word truth is in everybody's mouth. In 1984, I had prepared a production of Waiting for Godot with the St. Quentin Drama Workshop in Chicago. Beckett came over to London to lay his hand on it. We met at the Riverside Studios and Beckett saw a run through. There was a wonderful Lucky who put all his heart and soul into Lucky's speech for the love of Beckett's. Beckett was stunned. We sat there. Neither of us could speak or move. I could not hold my tears. I felt him keeping them under. After what seemed to be an eternity, he broke the silence. He leaned over to me and whispered, "The best Lucky I have ever seen." Meanwhile, the show had gone on. His capability of separating the husk from the grain was at times frightening, but never offending. The more we learn about him, through his letters, for example, or through research, the deeper will be the understanding for his work, and the less will be the desire to fool around with it or improve authors' work. Let audiences come and read in his plays like reading poems. To be hit by the magic of a beam, of a sequence in a performance of Rockabye may be worth more than any imposed explanations and interpretations. If it says at the end of a show report, "Several audience members visibly cried afterwards," they perhaps cried for happiness. Beckett didn't hold his hand over his heart, as Harold Pinter once said. We shouldn't hold ours over ours. Beckett was not an author or writer or dramatist. He was a poet. Through the beauty of his works, he remains a man of our time, more so than ever. Thank you very much.